October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and it began with a sobering reminder of what's at stake, another big breach affecting our personal data. This time, it was Facebook disclosing an attack on its computer systems affecting 30 million users, likely the most substantial breach of its network in the company history. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with Seth Pheasant and Kevin Krause from Illinois State University's Information Security Office about Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Pheasant started with the Facebook breach.
So as with any service, when you use that service, you're taking a risk. You're trusting that company with your information. For the users themselves in this situation, there's nothing they could really do. This wasn't them being compromised through social engineering or anything like that. It's Facebook's service as a whole that was targeted for the attack. The service on Facebook that was targeted was a feature called View As, and this was actually intended to help users enhance their privacy, meaning that for my Facebook profile, if I had one, I could view it as someone who's not my friend or as someone who is my friend to see what information is available to them. And it was this View As feature that was the target of the exploit, of the attack.
Let's bring in Kevin Krause, the Director of Information Security and Data Protection Officer at Illinois State University. Kevin, what can we control? As a day-to-day internet user, what are a couple things you think could make a big difference for protecting ourselves from various cyber threats?
One of them would be never share your user IDs and passwords amongst applications. Always make a separate password and make it long and complex. Another thing would be to never give it out in an email or over the phone to anyone. No one's ever going to really call you or email you and ask you for you to give them your user ID and password. If they are, be very suspicious of that. I think another thing that would be very interesting to most people is to actually go to Facebook or some of these other social media accounts and take a look at what information the company's actually tracking on them. And Seth can explain what he did when he looked through his profile and downloaded that information.
Yeah, Seth, what was that all about?
As we know, Facebook has been in the news a lot recently for probably about the last year or so for different reasons. And at the start of all this, I decided that my relationship with Facebook had come to a close. So I took advantage of a feature that Facebook offers where you can download the data that Facebook has on you. And after doing that, I deleted my account. And then looking back at some of the data that Facebook had collected, I was pretty shocked to see various data points. They had entire call records of who I called, at what time, for how long, the phone number, the contact name. For other users, they can collect location data of where you were, what you were posting, when you were in that location. And this is all used to build a profile around you. So to protect yourself online, it's really being conscious about what you're sharing and knowing how companies are going to be using this data to build profiles around you and eventually sell that to other companies.
That's really where they make their money, is in selling the data that they collect on all of us. And one of the nice features of GDPR is that companies, most big ones now, have the ability for you to see what information is being collected on you.
So I guess where does it cross the line from being, the way that the internet economy works in terms of tracking your behavior and then trying to sell you something on Amazon related to something that you've searched for? I guess where is that line where somebody should start protecting themselves against something? I think it's hard to tell where that line is.
I think that line's different for every person. That's the hard part to all of this, is everybody needs to decide how much of their own information they want to disclose and how much they want other companies to be able to use it. You might be perfectly willing for Amazon to track information about your shopping habits so you don't have to spend so much time looking for things that you've already bought. You want to rebuy them. But you may not be comfortable with Facebook selling your information to a polling or to a research firm for political purposes to try and determine how you're going to vote. Just as an example. So it's just out there all over.
You recommended passwords that were long and complex. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? How long? How complex?
Passphrases are what I would like people to use. That's what we encourage a lot, is coming up with something that is long. More than 20 characters is great. That's why you want a phrase, is something you can remember. Maybe sprinkling in some numbers and special characters or spaces even as you go along. That would be best. I know it's hard for people, which is why a good example would be is to take the dog jumped over the moon and make all the O's ones or make all the O's zeros. And then a special character at the end with a capital letter on moon would be a great example of a difficult password.
Seth, let's bring you into the conversation.
Password string is all about a term called entropy, which is just the degree of randomness. So historically, a lot of bad information has been given out around what a secure password is. If you look at any random person off the street's password, it's probably one relatively uncommon word with symbols and numbers placed in it. But really, just having a long password is really the most security-enhancing thing that you can do, because by adding each character, you're actually exponentially increasing the security of it. Whereas if you were to just capitalize a letter, that is only what we consider like one switch in entropy. Whereas if you add in a whole nother letter, you're completely changing the calculation of how many possible passwords you would have to try to guess that.
So what's the verdict from you guys on password management tools? Things like LastPass are pretty handy, but are they doing a good job in terms of protecting you?
They're doing about as good a job as you can do in that space. You know, anything you put into an application is vulnerable to attack. But generally speaking, it's a whole lot safer than writing them down on a post-it note and putting it under your keyboard or writing it down and keeping it on a piece of paper in your wallet. And if you're really trying to protect your entire self, having multiple passwords for every different application or a different password for every application is so important. It's hard for most people to remember one or two passwords, let alone 30 or 40 with our digital lives the way they are today. I mean, every bank would need a different one. Netflix, although I really don't care if my Netflix account gets hacked, but, you know, your Netflix, your Hulu, your Prime, all those things need different passwords to really keep you safe. You've got to have somewhere to put them, so password manager is really your best spot.
Seth, what do you think?
Myself, personally, I use a password manager, and I have, I believe, over 100 accounts, each with unique passwords stored in that. And on average, those passwords are about 50 characters or longer. And if you can remember all those, you're a better man than I am. So password managers really come in handy there, because if a service is compromised and your username and password are leaked from that service, if you're using the same password on multiple other services, those are likely compromised as well. That's very common for attackers, is to get one password for a user and just try it on a bunch of other popular services. And that gets really hard to determine if your account was accessed, because no other accounts were breached for some other service.
It's particularly easier nowadays because so many companies are using an email address for your user ID. So it's just a matter of passwords now, not guessing what your user ID is as well as your password.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham, speaking with Kevin Kraus and Seth Pheasant from the Information Security Office at Illinois State University about National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, which is this month, October. What do you make of these, you know, shared login systems that have seemed to kind of, you know, permeate around the whole internet now? You can use, you know, Facebook to log into all sorts of other services, and services cross back and forth using a shared login. Is that a risk area? Do you see that is that a good thing that exist or something to be concerned about?
From a user perspective, it's considered a good thing, I'm sure, because you only have to use the one credential. But just look what happened with Facebook a few weeks ago. Somebody would have had access to lots of other things besides just your Facebook account.
So if a user is faced with that option of use Facebook to log in to here, or use Google to log in to here, is there a best practice there or no real hard guidance?
The guidance I give out is really just something to keep in mind, which is, if you sign up for a lot of services using your Facebook or Google account, it makes it harder to move away from those services. So, for example, when I left Facebook, every service that I had signed up with as Facebook that I wanted to continue using, I had to go back to and recreate a new account and recover my old accounts. So that's a bit of a switching cost there for users that they need to be aware of. If anyone wants to look more into this, the term for this type of login is called federated login, and that's what you see with Facebook and Microsoft and all these other accounts. So the switching cost is pretty high. And again, if your account is compromised, every service associated with that is also potentially compromised.
Let's pivot and talk device security. For a long time, those of us who have iPhones were sort of walking around with a fortress in our pocket. At least it felt that way. You know, my iPhone can't get a virus, so nothing to worry about. But what are some of the things that you want people to think about when it comes to device security?
There's really no 100% secure device. Everything is vulnerable. Everything's got software. Software's vulnerable.
The number one thing, especially for cell phones, that I recommend, and this also applies to laptops and desktops as well, really anything that's mobile, is making sure that you are encrypting that device. Things get misplaced. Cell phones get misplaced all the time. They get stolen. Having your data encrypted gives you that extra peace of mind that if someone does end up with your phone, they're not going to be able to take all of your personal information off of that device.
And what do you mean by encrypted? Is that something the average person can do?
So the good thing about modern cell phones is by default, a lot of them are coming encrypted by default. So as long as you're using a passcode, a strong passcode, they offer all different types now, pins, swipe techniques, touch techniques. Your data is actually encrypted without you even having to think about it. But if you want to go that extra step just to make sure that it is, a quick Google search of your phone model will turn up a result.
Well, you know, three of us work at Illinois State University here, and we're routinely targeted by phishing emails that are trying to mimic a legitimate email, get you to click on something bad. I'm sure your filter protects against, you know, many more than the ones that even get through. But what is your guidance on how skeptical we should be on a day-to-day basis as we're checking our email?
I guess generally speaking, Seth and I don't trust any email that comes from anybody, not even from each other. But generally speaking, everybody should always be cautious of anything external. They should always be very cautious about any links that are put inside of them. And they should also know that ISU will never ask you for your user ID and password or to log in with your user ID and password from the Technology Support Center. That's just not something we would do. We won't ask for it and don't give it to anybody.
Is that probably true then for other institutional technology support units, State Farm or Wesleyan, other large employers?
Most employers communicate the same message. We'll never ask you to give us those credentials.
ISU's cybersecurity folks, Seth Pheasant and Kevin Krause, talking with GLT's Ryan Denham. ISU's IT Help social media accounts have been sharing some startling stats about cybersecurity all this month. Here is one for anyone who's noticed an uptick in scam phone calls recently. The percentage of scam phone calls rose to nearly a third of all U.S. mobile traffic last year. That's expected to rise to 44% by next year.